Financial support for WICN and programs like Inquiry come from listeners like yourself. So plan to take a moment out to consider becoming a member now by pledging online to WICN at wicn.org. Thank you. Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Roberto Trotta, astrophysicist at Imperial College London, and we're talking about his latest book, The Edge of the Sky, All You Need to Know About the All There Is. Roberto, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good being here.
This is the weirdest book, and I mean that in a good sense, about astrophysics that I have ever read. This is a book about contemporary cosmology, but there's a huge twist in it. What is that twist?
Well, as I say, it's a bit different from any of the books out there about cosmology. And the twist is that it's written using only the most common 1,000 words in English. So it's a book about the universe that doesn't use the word universe, in fact. It's called The All There Is.
How did you come up with the idea that seems like so counterintuitive that you would take a branch of science where the language, first of all, there's problems describing what there is. When I think about terms like supersymmetry and stuff like that, I mean, there are problems with the language as it is. And you decided to write a book with like, was it 10,000 words, most common words in the English language? How did this project start?
Well, that's precisely the reason why I wanted to try and see whether it was possible to do it using only the most common and therefore perhaps the simplest 1,000 words, because of this complicated jargon that we all use as scientists all the time. And this gets in the way to a clear communication of our science. And so why don't we make do without all of these complicated terms, use simple language that anybody can understand and call things in simple terms. And so this will make our science more accessible or generate new images and new perspectives on distant, complex, abstract concepts like the ones that we use in our everyday research, dark matter, dark energy, the Big Bang, etc.
Yeah.
The symmetry even, why not? The idea originally came from an XKCD cartoon. Now, XKCD is a very famous series of cartoons on the web, which is often humorous and about physics or computer science on very geeky subjects written by Randall Monroe. And one of the cartoons at one point had a picture of the Upgoer 5, that's to say the Saturn V moon rocket, which was labeled using only the most common 1,000 words. And so the rocket itself couldn't be called a rocket because rocket is not one of the words, and so it was called the Upgoer 5. And that's where the idea came from. And when I saw this cartoon, I thought, well, actually, maybe here is a format, a different type of language, which perhaps I can use to talk about the entire All There Is, that's to say the universe, in a different way and with a simple language for everybody, really.
It's an amazing project, an absolutely amazing project. Now, once you started it, were there points while you were trying to get this down when you thought to yourself, there's no way I can do this?
Oh, yes. It happened to me all the time at the beginning. In fact, the book wasn't born as a book at the beginning. It was born as an experimental project that I started for myself. I wanted to experiment with this language, with this format, to see whether it could be stretched to book length. I mean, the book itself is a short book, only 96 pages in the end, so it's not that long. But I didn't know that it was going to be a book in the end, because I really didn't know if it could work. And so at the beginning, I started sitting down, starting to think about how to describe the universe without using words such as universe or galaxy or planet. I didn't have any of those words, not even scientist. How do you do without all those words? Energy wasn't available either. And so, but then something amazing happened. Something strange started to emerge. A new voice started to be created by the by the language itself, by the format that I had given myself. And so I started finding new ways of talking about things. So, for example, the Milky Way, our galaxy, becomes the White Road, or galaxies become star clouds, and planets, those are crazy stars because they go around in apparent motion on the sky that doesn't match the other stars. And so little by little, I started having a new vocabulary at my disposal, and then it became easier and easier to work with it. And this new voice emerged from the lexicon, from the constrained lexicon itself. And the book is very much a book that's written with this voice that's like writing and reading in a different language, really.
It's a wild experience for readers to read, and I can tell you that because I read a lot of astrophysics and a lot of cosmology. And I found it like I thought it for my brain, it was weird. It was like I knew all the words, but it was like I had to conceptually link it up to ideas that I knew from before. It was a wild experience. But once you get into the rhythm of it, it works out. And I'm totally amazed that you were able to do this.
I'm very glad you say that, and yes, it's definitely different from anything you've read before, but also because half or more of the work is done by my readers. Yes, I put it in those simple words, but as you say, you need to read those simple sentences, and every single word will make perfect sense to you because those are very simple words that we use in everyday language, and you know, my 2 years daughter almost knows all of the words, not quite, but she's getting there. But then, you know, to link them up in images that make sense to you, that requires an effort of creative imagination
right.
through part. From the reader, and that's exactly what I want. I want to engage my readers. I want to stimulate them to think afresh about those concepts and to come up with their own mental imagery of what the universe looks like in this new language. And hopefully, that's my hope. And of course, only my readers will be the judges of my success with this little book. Hopefully, this will give them a new, fresh perspective on the universe, and it will give them childlike new eyes with which to look at this complex phenomena.
Well, one of the first things I thought of in my mind is when you're talking about particle physics and you're talking about things like quarks and charm, all those words were just arbitrarily chosen to begin with. So that the words don't really refer to anything. They were when physicists talk about spin and again charm as a property, those things don't really relate. We know the word, but it's not
right,
really.
They don't at all. So they're just placeholders for complicated mathematical notions that we, the physicists,
right.
the professionals of this discipline, have learned to associate with them. And then we forget that the public at large, they don't know about those things. And so we use those words, so black hole or galaxy or electron or Big Bang, and we think people understand us because those are words that people hear sometimes in the news and in the media, but they don't mean anything specifically to the public at large, or certainly not the same thing as the specialists mean by them. And so the whole idea is to just get rid of them and just use simple words instead, and those are words for which you will be able to come up with images for in a way that's unique to you and it's creative, and hopefully it's novel, and it will make you hopefully understand those concepts a bit better, and they will click into place in your mind.
Well, I think one of the advantages over the edge of the sky, over physics, is that when a person reads the term charm, we have a notion already what that word means, which has nothing to do with the property.
True.
And so there's a confusion, whereas you actually attempted to create words that weren't nonsense words, but that actually had meaning in relationship to the concept that you were trying to represent. So actually, your book was actually made more sense when you think about it than a lot of terms in particle physics.
Well, I hope so. I certainly hope so, and I'm happy to hear it from you as well, from somebody who's obviously has read a lot of astrophysics and knows what the lingo is in usual terms, and I don't want to use that. And I hope this works with people who have been exposed to those concepts before, but also with people who haven't necessarily been reading books about astrophysics before, and perhaps they've been put off by the usage of these strange words that don't mean what people maybe think they mean in all those other books about astrophysics and cosmology. And in my book, the words mean what they usually mean, and then the images that you associate with them are yours to create, in a sense.
And it's also not a textbook in that sense. It's actually a story. There's a person involved who is the main character of the story.
That's right. I wanted to talk about these concepts of dark matter, dark energy, the Big Bang, the origin of the universe, and the multiverse, the existence of other universes out there, perhaps, in a way that wouldn't be dry, wouldn't be technical, it wouldn't be a textbook, and I wanted a narrative. And so those ideas are bookended really by the story of a student woman, that to say, a scientist who goes out, a female scientist who goes out one night to seek the help of a large telescope, which is called Big Sear in the book, because telescope is not the one the world has to use, to unlock the mystery of dark matter. So we follow her adventures as she goes out on the top of this high mountain to make these observations from sunset to sunrise during the whole night, and we follow her thoughts, her actions, and what she thinks about the universe, the way we got to understand it, the way we understand it today, and also about the outstanding big mysteries that we still haven't cracked, and what we might be able to do about them in the future. And so really, it's a little bit of a nighttime story, in a sense, that tries to put all these difficult concepts within a more human scale framework.
What was interesting is that dark matter remains dark matter.
Yes, because both dark and matter are two words that I could use, and so that problem was solved. But for example, dark energy, because I didn't have energy, becomes the dark push. And the reason for that is because dark energy is this unknown form of energy that's pushing the universe apart, that's making it expand faster with time. And so it seemed fitting to call it the dark push.
I have to ask you this, because did you purposely challenge yourself to see if you could do this to some of the most difficult to understand concepts in astrophysics? Like when I got to the pieces about the multiverses, and I could not believe that you were able to get in the ideas of exoplanets. I mean,
yes.
I was like, so were you challenging yourself to see how far you could go with this?
No, I mean, not
because you covered a lot of ground in a very small book.
Yes, that's right. But the storyline, the arc of the narrative, came almost fully formed to my mind, because it's a distilled version, it's a condensed version of hundreds and hundreds of public lectures I've given over the years. And so I think I knew what people are usually interested in hearing about, and what are the big topics that I wanted to talk about in the book. And so the storyline was never the question. And so I didn't choose the storyline for the challenge. Then the challenge came with the story I wanted to tell, and so I had to rise up to the challenge. And whether or not I succeeded,
wow,
it, well, that's up to my readers to decide. But well, yes, I mean, the multiverse was, being the biggest question there is, trying to tackle the question of the multiverse, the existence of other universes with the 1,000 words only was a little bit like, I don't know, trying to cross the North Pole in flip-flops, you know, it's something crazy that you do with impossible means, and you know, you set out and hope for the best.
Well, you know, part of it from a reader's point of view is, first of all, I got sort of, after I passed through the original conceptual word challenge that was going on in my head, then I wanted to know how far you could go with this. And when I started getting to the multiverses, I went, I can't believe this. Now, I got to ask you this. You do a lot of public lecture. Are you ever going to do a lecture using this language?
Well, an entire lecture would be a tall order, for the same reason that The Edge of the Sky is a book of less than 100 pages. I don't think that the format quite stretches to, say, full book's length. You know, you couldn't write, I don't think I could write an interesting tome of 300 more pages using this language, because it's very intense, it's very dense in a sense.
Even oh, yeah.
Simple. And so in my book events and the book tour that I've been on, I do use this language for part of the talk, because I really want to expose the public to this kind of language.
Fantastic.
And what it does to the way we talk with each other, and give them a first-hand taster for it. I haven't done a full lecture using that language yet. I might in the future, but so far I've done bits and pieces, and people have seemed to enjoy it.
Well, what it ends up is you focus on concepts, not words. And that's part of the brilliant thing about this book, because you understand the concept and you realize the words are really just whatever you happen to name it. Like things like dark matter, You know, you could name it anything else for the time being. And that's dark matter happened to stick. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Roberto Trotta, astrophysicist at Imperial College London. And we're talking about his latest book. It is unique and an amazing read. The Edge of the Sky, All You Need to Know About the All There Is. Roberto, I want to talk about the illustrations. This is also a profusely illustrated book. Who did the illustrations?
So I'm so happy that I could work with this very talented young French artist called Antoine Depré. And Antoine really was great at interpreting the style of the book with his beautiful illustrations that really make a difference, make this book into such a much nicer object just to hold in your hands. And so what I wanted were illustrations that were simple and keeping in line with the simple language of the book that would translate the kind of aesthetic that I wanted for the language in visual terms. So we have one illustration per chapter, so there's 10 illustrations, and they're very simple drawings made with just black and white drawings. And you know, every time that somebody picks up the book and they look at the illustrations and they go, oh, this style really makes me think of something. It's a little bit like The Little Prince.
It really is. That's the first thing I thought of.
Great, didn't you? And it's exactly the kind of style I wanted for the book. That's exactly the model that I always had in the back of my mind. And it's amazing that Antoine was able to do it. And I'm really, really pleased. His contribution has been really wonderful. And I'm really pleased that the kind of style, the kind of feeling that I wanted to achieve has been, apparently has been achieved, because so many people say that. And I'm really, really happy about those illustrations.
Now, there's a glossary at the end of the book. So if there are some of the terms that you don't understand, you translate them. But let me tell you, in your introduction, there was a thing I didn't understand that you wrote in this using those common words. It's send me a note with the little blue flying animals. That wasn't in the glossary, so I have no idea what that meant.
So for some reason, some people told me that the little blue flying animal must be a squirrel or something. But no, actually, it's a little blue bird, and it's the logo of Twitter. So it's supposed to be saying tweet, and let me know what you think of the book.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. I kept thinking, like, you know, well, the old overseas mail used to be blue, you know, that you used to write on. And I had no idea what it was. Now, the fascinating thing about when you saw when you used the word crazy stars as planets, that was sort of reflective of the way the ancients talked about planets, too, as crazy animals. That wandered all over the sky.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's one aspect that I hadn't quite realized until I spoke with some of my readers during talks and events, and some people said, you know, I read your book, and to me it really feels a little bit like a mythological tale, people would talk about things.
Well, it definitely had that flavor of a translated, like, ancient text about the heavens. Mm-hmm. Except that they knew a hell of a lot more physics and cosmology than the ancient Greeks did, but it had that flavor to it, like you were reading a legend or something like that.
Yes, so in that sense, it is a strange mixture, because it really tries to explain cutting edge notions in astroparticle physics, cosmology, and speculative theoretical physics in sort of pre-language terms, or perhaps post-apocalyptic terms. You know, you can think of
exactly.
The future when we've lost all knowledge and this is all that remains, and that's kind of myth of what we once understood. What we once knew about the universe, if you like.
Could I ask you to read a section from the book to give the listeners a flavor?
With pleasure. She steps outside in the cold night, holding her cup of hot coffee with both hands. The wide road is beautiful in the dark, clear sky. And once again, she can't help but be amazed by it all. It doesn't matter how many times she has seen this before, or how much she knows about what is out there. The sight of the stars is enough to make her gasp. It all seems so still, and yet it's changing all the time, she whispers to no one. It is hard to believe that everything out there past the white road and its stars is running away from us. Yet, like Mr. Hubble found long ago, the star crowds are running away from each other as the space between them gets bigger and bigger. The older is growing with time.
Wow. It's, you know what? When you hear somebody read it, it has a whole other different effect too. It does sound very much like a story, like a legend, like a tale. And it's also very beautiful. It has a beauty to it that's unique. You don't usually find in cosmology texts. Now, I want to mention that a few proper names are used in the text. So Einstein, Hubble, Zwicky, Rubin, a couple of other proper names to talk about the history of it. But it reads like no other astrophysics book you're ever going to read. Now, the problem is you talked about is when you're talking about particles, there is no atom, there's no particle. What word did you have to use for particles?
Yes, I didn't have particles, so I used drops instead. So we have different kind of drops, and when those particles, when in usual language you would say particles get smashed together in a particle accelerator, which is what happens at CERN, at the Large Hadron Collider, well, I can't use particles, I can't use accelerator, I can't use smashing either. And so what I end up saying is that particles hug each other, and from their hot kisses, new drops come out. So it's this idea of drops kissing each other and hugging each other and occasionally kicking each other, which tries to convey the notion of this particle physics phenomena in a different way. But what you were saying to me is very, very important, the concept of beauty, because there is beauty in physics.
That's right.
In science, and too often we forget about it because we only think about it intellectually. And so what I was trying to do with The Edge of the Sky was to try to put back some of that creativity and passion into science, and so to find a way of expressing those ideas in a way that would speak to people's hearts, not just to their minds, and try to evoke emotions and passion as well, which is a big part of what science is about, actually.
And a lot of times when your brain sort of solved the immediate problem of what you were talking about, I got really tickled. I thought there's a sentence from when you talk about when Higgs picks up the Nobel Prize, you go, "For this, Mr. Higgs and another student man called Dr. Engelhardt had been asked to go to the important party in the ice water land." I just loved that. It was like, I laughed out loud when I read that, because that was such a funny description of winning a Nobel Prize. Now, this is off the subject of the book, because I know that dark matter is one of the important subjects and of research for you. This is an important time for research in dark matter, and I was just reading about the Dark Side 50 experiment.
Uh-huh.
What, can you talk about that, or is that not?
Yes, you are definitely right. This is now the sort of make or break moment for dark matter research. The next 5 years or so, I think, will tell us whether we can detect these dark matter particles in a laboratory experiment. And so, the experiment that you mentioned is one in a lineup of several direct detection experiments. Those are underground experiments, particle detectors that try to pick up the faint signal, what I call the dark matter whisper in the book. The faint signal of streaming dark matter particles through Earth. And so we believe that we have now a technology that's capable of detecting those particles if those particles are the kind of particles that our theoretical models predict them to be. But if they're not, and that would mean that our theoretical models are wrong or definitely on the wrong track, then in 5 years' time we won't have detected them, and the fact is that it's probably impossible to develop a technology that's much better than what we have now, and it might be that we won't be able to detect them ever, in which case it would be a little bit the end of the road for dark matter research, at least in terms of the current ideas.
But that doesn't mean
it's really a very exciting time.
But that doesn't mean the dark matter isn't there, because I mean, the fact that we can't detect them doesn't mean it's not there. We just don't have the technology to detect them.
That's right. But we have plenty of circumstantial evidence for the existence of dark matter from the universe by looking at the motions of visible things in the cosmos and how they are influenced by the presence of dark, invisible stuff. But that's kind of indirect. What we really want to do is to be able to see the dark matter particle or produce it in the lab at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, for example.
Yeah.
And if we can't do either of those things, then we are kind of stuck, because we won't be able to confirm in a absolutely clear and robust way the nature of those particles. And so we might get stuck with speculative theories for a long, long time.
What I'm amazed about in The Edge of the Sky is that you tackled the description of the multiverse. My hat goes off to you, because I would never have expected that you could do that with these kinds of constraints, yet you managed. And actually, I think you put it in such a way that people would understand the concept actually much better than if they read any other science book.
Thank you. That is definitely my hope. As I said before, this lexicon, this straitjacket of this lexicon that I've given myself, at the beginning it was very frustrating, but then towards the end it actually felt liberating, because it really forced me to think about these ideas anew, with new eyes, with a new perspective, and come up with metaphors and imagery and ways of talking about the multiverse, for example, which is described with a table full of 400 coins.
I love that.
Heads.
Yeah.
It's very pictorial. It's something that everybody can picture in their head, and you can imagine how many 400 coins are, and how improbable it is to get 400 heads if you toss them all at random over a table, and that is essentially the concept of the multiverse, and why our universe is so strange and so apparently fine tuned for life, as improbable as getting 400 heads out of 400 coins all tossed at random. I think it's a really striking example of how small the probability is and how strange our universe actually appears, and therefore how important it is that we understand the origin of this statistical anomaly, and whether or not it's the multiverse remains to be seen.
You also, I want to just mention before we go, you begin every chapter with a haiku.
Yes.
I love that. I thought that, first of all, this whole project lends itself to haiku, and you begin every chapter with that, which again adds that whole aesthetic, poetic layer to this project.
I was trying to find a way of condensing it down to an even shorter, even more condensed form. And so there is a short haiku, a three-liner haiku for each chapter. There is 30 chapters in the book. So if you put all the haikus together, you get the entire All There Is described in just 30 lines or 63 different words. And that's a doubly condensed version of what I was trying to do, to explain the entire universe using the smallest amount and the simplest choice of words.
I'm going to end with the haiku from part 9. So many worlds, all that can be is. Wonderful. My guest tonight has been Roberto Trotta, astrophysicist at Imperial College London. And we're talking about his amazingly unique book, The Edge of the Sky, All You Need to Know About the All There Is. Roberto, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.